Well, if you've got a Bible, I do encourage you to turn to Mark's Gospel, chapter 8 and verse 22. You'll find it on page 1011. For those of you just joining us for today, we have been journeying through this Gospel, which means good news. It's written by John Mark, who was a young man, and he had pieced together from eyewitness accounts of Jesus' life what Jesus had said, and more importantly, what he'd done. For John Mark, who was a young man, he was in a hurry to get everything down. It's a very pacey, racy, brief account of Jesus' life. And we've got to chapter 8. And in this reading that we have today, we have another practical encounter between Jesus and someone in need, and then a most profound conversation. So let's start off with a practical encounter. Jesus meets a man who is blind. This man, Jesus looks at with compassion, and he takes him to one side so that the healing that he's going to do to him can be a private encounter. Jesus probably knew that for this man to be healed in the front of everybody, it would just be overwhelming. So he took him to one side. The thrill of seeing could then dawn on him slowly. And this was commonplace for Jesus. He was, after all, the Son of God. He was able to make people well. And Mark records so many accounts of him doing just that. It's a very earthy encounter, this one, in an area which had a curious belief in the healing power of spittle. We're told Jesus spat on the man's eyes. It's not so strange, though, is it really? Because if we cut a finger, our first instinct today would be to put it into our mouth, wouldn't it? So it's not so different from their ideas of the time. Jesus uses a method of healing that the blind man would have been very familiar with. He could understand it. And the other interesting thing is that this is the only miracle that is recorded in Mark's Gospel where things happen gradually, alongside the more dramatic encounters where something happens in an instant. This seems to take place over a period of time. And in my experience, that has been the case too, of seeing people gradually healed. So both can happen. So the practical encounter. And then we move to a great discovery. Now, the scene is set near a place called Caesarea Philippi. It had, in an earlier era, been actually a place where the god Baal was worshipped. He was a pagan god. And a nearby cave was, according to legend, the birthplace of the Greek god Pan. And at this time, Philip, who was the local ruler when Jesus lived, the local ruler of this area, had erected a huge temple up on the hillside. It wasn't to the god that the Jews worshipped, it was to the emperor Caesar, who, of course, the Romans regarded as a god themselves. So there's the backdrop, quite literally, to this scene up on the hillside, these various reminders of a pantheon of gods. And here, of all places, Peter, a homeless Galilean carpenter who's dropped everything to follow Jesus, finally works out who he is. Here, of all places, against the backdrop of all of these different religions and all history, Peter realizes that this wandering teacher that he's been following around the countryside, who is heading for execution, is the Son of God. This was perhaps the moment of greatest crisis for Jesus. He knew in his own heart that in front of him led to an inescapable conclusion, the cross. Things couldn't go on like this much longer. If you remember some of the readings we've done in Mark's Gospel, you'll know that Jesus encountered people who welcomed him, who he healed. And then he encountered people who were very suspicious of him. And that was mostly the religious authorities, the people with power. And behind the scenes, the people with power realized that their power was being undermined by this man, and they were plotting to get rid of him. So Jesus knew the writing was on the wall. And the question in his mind, the question that was confronting him at this moment, was, has anything I've said or done really had any effect? Has anybody worked out who I really am? Because if no one has glimpsed a picture of God in me, then all my work is for nothing. You see, this was a key, critical moment for Jesus. And so, first of all, he does a bit of a straw poll. He asks the question, well, what are other people saying about me? And he gets the answer from the disciples. Well, some of saying you're Elijah, who was a prophet, a very revered prophet from the past. He's come back to life, some people think. Still others say you're John the Baptist, who'd also been killed and come back to life, perhaps in their minds. And others, another of the prophets. So there's a whole mixture of ideas, but of course that wasn't quite what Jesus wanted them to get. So if you were Jesus, the pressure would be rising. Crowds haven't worked out who I am. I wonder if the people who've spent the last 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 months with me have worked it out. So he poses the question. It's a bit of a risk, isn't it? Who do you say that I am? He says to the disciples. You see, the answer to this question meant so much more to Jesus than what the crowds would say. What are his disciples? What would they say? Had they got it? Well, Peter had got it. And he hit the nail on the head. He said, you're the Messiah. You are the one sent by God. That's what the word Messiah means. The chosen or the anointed one. Peter got it. But then bizarrely, Jesus tells him straight away not to tell anybody else. How ridiculous. How bizarre. Why? Why on earth did Jesus tell him to stay quiet? And the reason for this is that Jesus had to tell them what being the Messiah really meant. And again, to understand why that's the case, why Jesus told them to be quiet, you have to understand the backdrop to what the Jewish people thought. They thought the Messiah meant. You see, there were many Jewish ideas of what the Messiah meant. The Jews were a very special people. They knew they were special and chosen by God. And the pinnacle of their history had been when King David ruled many hundreds of years before. And when they'd built an incredible temple to God, his son Solomon had built that temple. And one of the Psalms that we read today was written by King David, who was a soldier king. But everything had gone downhill in the few hundred years since David had been around. The Jews had been conquered and subjugated by the Babylonians, by the Persians, by the Greeks, and now by the Romans. And so the Jewish people had been longing in their hearts for a day when God would intervene in history and achieve by supernatural power what their human activity had not managed to achieve. This Messiah would come and restore their nationhood and their temple. And so this Messiah would be one of the most destructive conquerors in history, because the Romans weren't going to just lie down and take it. They were the biggest power in the world. And the Jews had this idea that the Messiah was going to completely destroy the Roman Empire. That would have been a bloodbath. But that's what they believed. And they believed that Palestine would replace Rome as the center of the world, and all the world would be subject to them. And a new era of peace would begin, not Pax Romana, but Pax Jerusalem. And so the messianic ideas that the Jews had were violent, they were destructive, they were nationalistic, and they were vengeful. So do you get what Jesus meant when he said, you mustn't tell anybody that I'm the Messiah? Because they'd have run away with their thoughts, and they'd have expected him to fill the picture that they had. You understand why he was not ready for his true identity to be revealed yet? because there's no room for a cross. There's no room for suffering love in that picture. And so Jesus goes on to explain the truth about his messiahship. And what he says was not politically correct then, and it's certainly not politically correct today. Political slogans then and now, and we hear a lot of them at the moment by two people in particular, tell us in many ways that things can only get better. Do you remember the song from 1997 with the Labour Party? Well, Jesus says, yes, things can get better, and they will get better, but before that, and they'll get better beyond your wildest dreams, by the way, but before that, the route to things getting better is not getting, it's giving. It's more than just giving, it's actually being prepared to lay down your life for other people. That's the way things are going to change. So the disciples are staggered. Peter took his master aside and he rebuked Jesus. How arrogant of Peter. How rude. Peter rebukes his master. It's because Peter was so shocked by what Jesus was saying. It just didn't compute with his idea of this conquering Messiah. A Messiah going to death on a cross? Well, Jesus equally, robustly, says to Peter, his closest friend and disciple, "Get behind me, Satan." It's a pretty robust conversation they have. You see, Jesus already had an encounter with the devil in the desert, and he knew in his heart that this is exactly what the devil would want him to do, to give up on his plan of suffering love and to step into the shoes of the messiahship that everybody else was expecting. And of course, Jesus says, I could bring down legions of angels if I wanted to. But he chose not to. Sometimes, well-meaning friends can offer us the wrong advice, can't they? Thinking that they want to protect us from harm. In this case, Jesus ignored Peter because sacrifice was the right thing to do. It was to be Jesus' path. And he explained that this would have to be the path for his disciples too. And that means me and you. Friends, today we are standing on holy ground because these words in chapter 8 and verse 35 to 37 are about as close as you could get to the heart and the center of the Christian faith. You see, Jesus was brutally honest. He didn't gloss things over. He never sought to lure people by false offers of only things that he managed. He didn't manage the truth. He said it as it was. Churchill, at the beginning of World War II, said, "All I have to offer you is..." Thank you, Richard. "Blood and sweat and tears." Have any of you seen the recent Chernobyl series? Anybody watch that? No? Okay. It's well worth watching. It's a bit harrowing. There's a moment in that series where they've put the fire out, but the core of the reactor is still very, very hot. And in fact, it's so hot, it's burning through the concrete base. And the worry is that as it burns through the concrete base, it will infect the water, groundwater, which will then affect the river running nearby, which they'd use for cooling water, which is the water supply for 50 million people down the river. So, the Minister of Mines goes with his heavies to a local mine, and they turn up and they tell the miners to come out, 400 of them, and they say, "You're coming with us." And these miners, you know, pretty roughy-tufty bunch, the foreman comes out and says, "We're not going anywhere." And the Minister of Mines, in his sharp suit, says with his soldiers, he said, "Well, I'm going to kill you all then." He said, "Well, kill us all then. We're not going anywhere unless you tell us where we're going." And so eventually he does something which was very unusual for ministers in the Soviet Republic at that moment, maybe even today. He told the truth. He said, "You've got to go to Chernobyl and you've got to dig a tunnel under a meltdown nuclear reactor, so that we can put a heat pump under this reactor with nitrogen and all other kind of stuff." And the foreman turned around and said, "You told us the truth now. will come. So 400 of them went, dug this tunnel, they put the heat pump in, and they managed to cool the reactor down. I don't know how many of those 400 died, but they went because someone told them the truth. Jesus, secondly, led by example. He didn't say to them, this is what you must do, and I'll be watching here from my comfy sofa space. He said, no, I'm going to go and do this thing. I'm going to go to the cross, and you need to follow me. And finally, Jesus said, you must deny yourself. You have to say no to yourself, to your own desires, and you've got to put other people first, each day and every day. You've got to be prepared to shun comfort. You've got to be prepared to say no to every action that is based on self-seeking. You've got to say no to temptation, and you've got to say yes to Jesus. Whoever seeks to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me and for the gospel will save it. There's a story many years before Jesus of, not many years before Jesus, years after Jesus, of a hermit called Telemachus. He lived in the desert, but one day God told him to go to Rome. So he went to Rome, and Rome by now had become Christian, but they still enjoyed the gladiatorial games. They weren't throwing Christians to the lions anymore, but what they were doing was using people that they captured prisoners, and they would be thrown into the arena and they'd have to fight each other to the death for entertainment. Well, Telemachus was there watching this happen. He was so shocked by it that he jumped off of his seat, went into the middle of the arena, so we're told, and stood between these enormous gladiators and said, you must stop, this is wrong. Well, the prefect who was running the show could see that the crowds were getting a little bit unsettled because they paid their money for a show. Eventually, he couldn't get rid of Telemachus, so Telemachus was killed. But then there was a holy moment, a hush. This holy man had been killed. News got to the Christian emperor, Honorius. He was so impressed by the martyrdom of this monk that it spurred him on, so we're told, to issue an edict, and there was never a gladiatorial contest ever again. One man laid down his life as a blessing to others. You see, God gave us our lives to spend, not to keep. We can live carefully, husbanding our life, protecting ourselves from risk, thinking first of our own profit, our comfort, our security. We can make it our sole aim in life to make our life as long and as trouble-free as possible. But that, Jesus said paradoxically, is not really living. It's just existing. In fact, it's losing the full life that he promised. John 10:10, which we oft quote, says, Jesus came that I may bring you life and life in all its fullness. Well, you see, life in all its fullness is not about protecting yourself from harm or danger or risk. It's about getting involved in the mess and not walking away. Jim Elliot was an American Bible missionary who was compelled with some friends to go and to tell a remote Ecuadorian Indian tribe about the love that God had for them. Well, they got there, they started to tell this tribe, and the tribe didn't take it well, and all five of them were killed by this tribe in the 1950s. And he wrote these words in his journal before, obviously, that had happened. And they're some of the most oft-quoted Christian words ever. And they say this: he is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose. You see, the obvious truth is that none of us can keep hold of our lives. They're drifting through our hands like sand. That's the truth of it. One day they will come to an end. But what are we going to do with them before that? Are we going to make a difference for eternity? Or are we going to try and protect ourselves? Suppose you gain all the world's riches, Jesus says, or at least just good payouts from your pension, and lose your very soul. Suppose you own a beautiful house with a lovely garden where I live. Don't own it, but I live there. Or you own a beautiful sailing boat, and I have a lovely sailing boat. But again, it consumes your time so much that you neglect your family or your faith, and you lose your very soul. You see, in one sense, Mark's gospel is a succession of challenges to make up your mind. Make up your mind. This is the crunch. What kind of a disciple are you going to be? So if you are already a disciple today, and some of us here are, I know, a follower of Jesus, well, you need to think about this challenge. Perhaps you've been coming to church for a really long time, but actually all this talk about being a disciple or a follower is a little bit alien. Perhaps it's made you wonder if you really are a follower. Well, come and talk to me or to Merv. We'd love to talk about that with you. What does it mean to be a follower of Jesus Christ? And it may be as well that there are folk here today for whom this is all very, very new. And you can't honestly say that you are a follower of Jesus. And all this stuff about laying down your life and putting other people first is a bit difficult to get your head round. Again, can I encourage you to talk to somebody about it? There are some really interesting little books at the back of the church called Why Jesus. In there you'll find out a little bit more about who he was and why he challenges us to live in this way. We're going to have a moment of quiet reflection now as we are led beautifully by the choir in the anthem, Jesu, Lamb of God, the words of which remind us of what Jesus has done for us and help us to think about what we can do in response. The choir anthem, Jesu, Lamb of God.